On this episode of the China Unscripted podcast, the shifting propaganda campaign during the coronavirus, how the CCP virus compares with Chernobyl, and what the U.S. should do to hold the Chinese Communist Party responsible. Welcome to China Uncensored. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshda, and this show is not actually China Uncensored, it's China Unscripted.
Oh,
good thing you were there to pick up that ball.
I know, yeah. Otherwise our listeners would not have known, Chris.
What? How many shows do we have?
Not enough. I think we should do more.
Welcome to America Scripted Uncovered.
We could just have one show called Coronavirus.
we had that one bit of like cooking unnourished.
Oh, yes.
Our cooking show.
Oh, yeah, that was a good idea.
Russia Unmasked.
There's we should keep some of these things. Games Unplayed.
Oh, as our Let's Play channel?
Yes, except we would have to play the game, so...
Oh, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
We got to work that out.
Unfinished. Games Unfinished.
There we go.
We just play the first 30 minutes of any game. Which is going to be really difficult for Death Stranding, because like the first hour of that is just cutscenes.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ah, Kojima. Hey, anyways, we have a podcast to get to. And joining us today is Senior Analyst for Strategy at the Center for Security Policy, J. Michael Waller. Thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be on your show.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about the coronavirus that's been spreading around. Just for clarity, one thing we've been doing on the show a lot to sort of emphasize the responsibility the Chinese Communist Party has in its spread, we've been calling it the CCP virus. So just so nobody gets confused if we use that term to refer to the coronavirus.
It's more clinical and specific than corona.
I think so. Thank you. Well, so tell us, you've been really looking at the timeline of the coronavirus outbreak, the CCP virus outbreak. How did this all begin?
It began in about November last year. And people didn't really know what to make about it in Wuhan. And finally, there was an outbreak in December when things started getting to real concern to the Wuhan scientists at their hospitals. And sure enough, some of the scientists were discussing among themselves that this was a health outbreak issue. And they went for advice and they got none. And in fact, they were persecuted for it and repressed for it. And then the Chinese authorities in Wuhan had to wait for orders from Beijing, which didn't come for a long time. And that's how the pandemic basically broke out.
So why did the Communist Party cover this up?
Well, they have to cover these kinds of things up. You know, just like the Soviets did in Chernobyl, they have this propaganda line that they're invincible, that they're responsible for everything good, and anything bad in the country is due to outside sabotage or somebody else's fault. So the party can never take blame for anything, but it has to take credit for everything. And in a top-down system like the CCP in China, especially under the current leadership now, Xi Jinping, where he has centralized the apparatus more than anybody since Mao, everyone down the chain is afraid to move and do anything different unless they get approval from the top. And this goes all the way down to the hospitals and the labs and the city authorities in Wuhan, where they didn't dare move until they got instructions from Beijing, which didn't come for a very long time.
The Wuhan mayor even tried to kind of point that out when he was getting a lot of flack, right, for not really alerting people. And he was saying, you know, he actually said publicly, which I was a little bit surprised that he would do this. He said that, you know, they had to wait for authorization from Beijing for like public health policy things.
Right. Can you imagine the mayor of a city having to wait for the president of the United States to tell him what to do? It's insanity. And so this is the type of system that it bred. And of course, when something like this goes out of control, it's not according to the party script. It's not according to party protocols. And so repression takes place. Anybody who speaks out will be repressed. You saw medical officials and scientists being repressed. You saw citizen journalists disappearing. You saw the scientist or the physician, Dr. Li, who blew the whistle on this within his own community, coming down with the virus and dying. But he was disgraced until after it was decided to rehabilitate him after he died.
And so I guess because of this nature of the Communist Party, we now have hundreds of thousands of people dead around the world.
That's right. And trillions of dollars worth of economic damage. And fundamentally, somebody has to be responsible for this, and that's the Chinese Communist Party. We have to hold them as responsible for this as we would for anyone doing any type of damage. If an American chemical company was responsible for the Bhopal incident in India years ago, Union Carbide, and they had to pay out damages, well, same thing with the CCP. CCP is just a private corporation that runs China. It's not the other way around. So as such, the party itself is responsible for this pandemic.
I mean, you know, if American law firms, there's several different lawsuits seeking damages from China. I mean, what do you think the result of that's going to be?
Well, a lot of lawyers are going to get rich.
Oh, good.
Isn't America. That
good? What a solution. Boy. Yeah. And of course, it'll be lawyers representing the Communist Party. They won't say they are. They're saying they're representing some Hong Kong company, but it's really their tools of the Communist Party. There's no shortage of them in New York City and elsewhere who are already been lined up to do the party's work here in America. So they'll clog up our court system for years. Little will come out of it. What I've been proposing is that we simply take what they won't pay, meaning the United States government should default on all of its debts to the CCP. That's about $1 trillion worth right there. The U.S. should not bail out any investment fund or pension fund that has stock in or in other investments in CCP companies, like so many of them do. No bailouts for them. Those American investors should divest themselves of all CCP equities and drive the price down.
So you're saying that the Federal Reserve's, you know, say $2 to $5 trillion bailout that they're engaging in now with through quantitative easing. Are you saying that the Fed shouldn't bail out any American companies that are invested in China?
We should help them to leave China, but if they want to stay in China and work with the CCP, we shouldn't be subsidizing that. These companies need to pay for the mistakes they made, and their investors need to pay. Myself included, I found out some of my retirement funds were invested in Chinese stocks. Who knew? We need to all learn a lesson from this and pay attention to the fund managers and others who made deals with the CCP. It can't be any worse than what we've already undergone economically, and we have to really make the party pay. Now, this goes even further. The U.S. should organize for other countries to get out of their debt traps to China. Not necessarily organize them, but welcome them aboard, saying, let's all default at the same time.
What kind of impact do you think that would have on China?
Well, it would bankrupt the CCP, for one. It would undo the Belt and Road Initiative. Just think if Sri Lanka and Pakistan and these other countries all of a sudden all defaulted at the same time. They could keep the infrastructure that the CCP built for them, shoddy as much of it is, and free themselves of these many billions of dollars worth of debts that they owe to the CCP and the CCP companies.
I mean, the United States in 230 years has never defaulted on any of its debts. So wouldn't this also have a negative impact on the U.S. to default on $1 trillion worth of treasury securities?
Well, I'm not a finance guy, but if everyone did it at once, then it sets a new standard, just like after World War II. Like you would think also, say, during the Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt took America off the gold standard, all of a sudden our currency is not backed by gold anymore. What a radical step that was to have currency not backed by gold. Yet our dollar survived and it became the world's dominant currency after that. So if the rest of the world gets together and says, we are simply going to default on these corrupt debts to this corrupt system of the CCP all at the same time, then you have a new precedent that the whole world's standing by except the Chinese Communist Party and its friends.
So this really could be a regime ender for the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. That's the idea.
Well, it's interesting, but I think U.S. debt to China is a little different than like Pakistan's debt to China, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of different types of debts to China under very different terms. But if everyone just defaulted at once, what are the Communist Party people going to do? And to say nothing of the properties that the party owns here in the United States. They have a huge corner on a chunk of our national pork supply, owning Smithfield Foods and all of those other subsidiaries, Nathan's Hot Dogs and everything else that we don't even think of as
CCP owns Nathan's Hot Dogs?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Well, there goes the 4th of July Coney Island hot dog eating.
I know.
It'll be the same again.
It's the end of America.
Sorry to ruin that for you. There are a lot of other brands we like, too, and they're owned by CCP companies, which overpaid for this, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago when it was an old company set up during the early Mao era in the late 50s, state-owned Chinese company that went up and bought Smithfield for billions and billions of dollars. So they own plants around the country, and they own a large piece of the U.S. pork supply and protein supply, and to say nothing of all the real estate that's owned and agricultural property that's owned. You know, that stuff should all be confiscated. Federal government should take it under emergency powers, because it's not private property. It's Communist Party property of a foreign entity, and then auction it off to American buyers, and then use that money to help repay the CARES Act and all the other damages that we've suffered, and take that as partial reparations from the party.
So this seems the crux of what you're saying is, you know, the reason the Chinese Communist Party has so much influence in the United States is because, you know, for years there's been this idea that we should invest in China, and a lot of companies and people were eager to do that. Do you think that people's view of China is going to change because of the coronavirus? I know the Communist Party is really trying to spin a propaganda narrative to not blame them for the coronavirus.
Right. And it's so childish sometimes. Like, I didn't do it. He did it. Now their latest one is they're coming back to the idea that the United States military started this. And since we're not being frank and open about it, obviously we, the Americans, are covering this up. And scientists can never really know if the virus originated at Fort Detrick Lab in Maryland or not. So they're throwing this back at us to deflect from themselves. And then they accuse us of deflecting.
Yeah. I'm sure they'll get back to the let's not point fingers thing in a couple of days.
Yeah. Oh, they're on that already. They're still on that.
And you've been following sort of the changing narrative of how the Chinese regime has dealt with the CCP virus since December. And you've put a timeline on your website that sort of goes through some of this stuff. How would you, you know, take us through a bit of how the narrative the CCP has been spinning about the coronavirus has changed over the last few months?
Sure. There are several different stages. And the first stage, well, whenever a totalitarian entity, or an entity that has to run completely by script, gets thrown off key by some unexpected incident, the first thing they do is clam up. And that is to crack down on people, to repress people, to prevent any news from getting out so that they can figure out what kind of narrative they take. And the Central Propaganda Department of the Chinese Communist Party is bigger than the United States State Department. So they have a lot of people working on this propaganda line. It's developed at various levels, and then it's sent up to the top for approval. And sometimes it's developed at the top and sent downward for enforcement. But everything has to match. So there's a lot of coordination, and this takes a lot of time. And then they have to figure out what kind of theatrics are involved. How do we execute those theatrics for made-for YouTube-type presentations? How do we use it on traditional outlets like Xinhua or the authoritative party publication People's Daily? Or what can we put out on TikTok and other social media channels fronts? And then how does this work in different languages to different audiences? And all that's coordinated. So it took literally 3 weeks from the time that Beijing was alerted to the nature of this outbreak to when Xi Jinping finally came out of hiding. He wasn't seen for 3 weeks. And then around January 20th, he finally made a public appearance and made a public statement, this is what we're going to do. So they did nothing for those first 3 weeks publicly except repress word of things and figure out how they were going to scramble to create their line. Meanwhile, while covering up the facts from us, they prevented the rest of the world from knowing the extent of the virus and therefore prevented the world from preparing for the virus. Yet at the same time, the Communist Party instructed its operatives around the world to buy up as much Western safety material as goggles, that's face masks, that's respirators, buy it up and ship it back to China. So they're hoarding all of the world's best supplies during this whole period when we could have been warned.
About the supplies thing, are you saying it wasn't just individual Chinese people buying masks from Amazon, but it was a coordinated effort by the Chinese Communist Party?
Yes. Yes, this was revealed in Australia, and it subsequently came out elsewhere. And then 3M and some of these other companies recently reported that they had a huge spike in orders from China in January. These were instructions by the party to party-run firms around the world, or firms run by members of the party around the world. So, for example, in Australia, there was a very large Chinese real estate company that dropped everything they were doing to buy masks to ship back to China.
Well, I know early on, Taiwan tried to raise the warning. You know, they had experience dealing with the Communist Party and cover-ups of diseases, SARS. Why were they ignored?
Yeah, well, this is an important point because Taiwan warned on the 31st, and they started screening people flying in from Wuhan right away. So they warned the Chinese authorities, the health authorities, and they warned the World Health Organization. They were ignored because Taiwan is a non-existent entity. It's kind of like Israel was 30 or 40 years ago, where you can't even say the word because it's not real and therefore it doesn't exist. It might be a so-called breakaway province from the mainland, but it's not a sovereign entity that people should pay attention to, according to the party line. And then the World Health Organization doesn't admit Taiwan as even an observer member because Beijing doesn't want it to be that way. So the World Health Organization, really, it's not so much a health entity as it is a political entity that deals with health issues. So whereas they might have listened to Taiwan, they could not embarrass their controlling entity, which is the Chinese government, by saying that Taiwan has discovered and uncovered something that the party is covering up.
How is it that the Communist Party has been so successful at getting the World Health Organization to continue to parrot its message? Like, the World Health Organization still says China has been amazingly transparent in the coronavirus, which just anybody can see that that's not true.
Yeah, how can you believe anything the World Health Organization says anymore when, you know, everyone across the political spectrum agrees that there's a problem? Yeah, the Chinese government, like the Soviet government from a generation or two ago, invested a lot in infiltrating international organizations. Any UN entity, the United Nations bureaucracy, the Secretariat, UNICEF, World Health Organization, and others like that. The Chinese regime used its diplomatic pressure to get member nations of the UN to vote for its favored candidates. Some were People's Republic of China nationals. Most were not, but they were those who they knew would do China's work for it in those organizations. So while Beijing never funded very much of any of these entities, especially if it's the world's second largest economy and most populous country, it's a tiny fraction in comparative and absolute terms of what they're contributing to fund them. They really let us Americans fund these organizations, be the largest funder of them, while they controlled them. And we in the U.S. never took these organizations that seriously in recent years, or at least thought there was some mentality, well, we're only one country out of 190-odd countries in the world. We only have one vote. When, of course, that's not how the game is played.
That seems, well, stupid. How did we get into that situation?
Oh, it was that way even going. Well, first, think of it. The United States created these organizations. The United Nations itself was created during World War II with the Allies, United States, France, United Kingdom, then the Soviet Union, and the Republic of China, not the People's Republic of China. So it's the Republic of China, whose government fled to Taiwan, was a founding member of the United Nations. Over a while, you know, that government got kicked out, but the United States and the Soviets were battling within the United Nations for the world narrative with the superpower competition, and to put its own interests forward, and to also sometimes even solve world problems. So, but the United States lost the vision of what these organizations were for, meaning that the purpose of it was, for our point of view, and from U.S. and France and Britain, the democratic founders of the U.N., and the Republic of China on Taiwan, was to advance world interests and their own national interests against Soviet communism. pretty much gave that up in letting the Soviets infiltrate and take over so much of the UN Secretariat. And in fact, there was a Soviet official, Arkady Shevchenko, who was the number two official in the UN, who defected to the United States in the 80s and described exactly how the Soviets had done this. Anyway, we didn't learn that lesson, and we allowed then Beijing to take the Soviet place to infiltrate and subvert these organizations.
So you think it's, do you think the United States, after the fall of the Soviet Union, just let its guard down and then China basically took the Soviet playbook?
Yes. Yeah. We thought, hey, the Cold War's over. We don't need to be on our guard anymore. And oh, by the way, look at these great folks in Beijing who want to make the world a better place and make a lot of us in the business and foreign policy and political establishments prestigious and wealthy. So let's go along with what they want and say that it's really not what it is.
I understand you've, speaking of the Soviets, spent many years looking at Soviet propaganda, analyzing that. How would you compare what Beijing is doing to what the USSR did?
Well, both types of regimes, I mean, the People's Republic of China model, the Communist Party model, is based on it's a modified version of the old Soviet model. It's modified to special Chinese standards, and it's been upgraded a lot. So it's really a Chinese high-tech version of the old Soviet model.
Socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Somebody once called it that, yes. So the they can't exist without propaganda. They have to propagandize their own people internally, and they have to propagandize the rest of the world about how great they are, how invincible they are, how they are the future of the world, and they're a benign future that seeks peace, and they can't say brotherhood anymore because that's too binary for them, but they you know, humanity's sake and so forth. And they make themselves look as the rising powers in comparison to the rest of the world, which is declining. So let's all go on the Soviet or the Chinese bandwagon because they represent the future. They have to have this propaganda in order to keep their legitimacy. They can't exist without it. Because once the truth comes out, their legitimacy is gone. And this gets back to the Wuhan virus or the CCP virus, because when the truth gets out about who started the virus or who allowed the virus to escape and become a pandemic, all the blame goes back to the CCP.
What do you think are the obstacles in people realizing that it is, in fact, China? Like, I've seen articles in both state-run media and Chinese state-run media and Western media saying that, you know, President Trump is more to blame than China or the WHO.
Yeah. And now think of the brilliance of that. This virus begins, or the leakage begins, in a lab in Wuhan. It spreads through Wuhan. The Communist Party represses it. It represses the doctors who discover it. It disappears the journalists who report about it in an unauthorized way. It does nothing for weeks to warn the world, and it's Donald Trump's fault.
Now you,
I mean, that logically makes sense.
Of course, yeah.
Now you mentioned that you think it came from a lab in Wuhan. There's been a lot of debate about, you know, originally it was said it came from a wet market in Wuhan. Now the United States is investigating if it actually did come from a high containment laboratory in Wuhan. So you seem to think it was from a lab?
Yes, and here's one of the things that you can really benefit by propaganda analysis. You take what the regime is saying or not saying, and you look at what it's doing or not doing, and then you listen to what it's saying to its own cadres, especially when it's different from what it's saying and doing publicly. So one of the first things that we find, and it didn't come out at the time, it came out many weeks later, was that the party apparatus from the center, from Beijing, instructed that security at the Wuhan Institute of Virology have its security upgraded. It's one of the first steps the party instructed from Beijing. But of course, they didn't publicize it. And all the time, they're denying that it had anything to do with any lab. Yet they're telling their own people, fix the problem at the lab. That tells us that they know something's going on at that laboratory.
Yeah, not wet market reform.
Well, they actually are talking about that now a lot.
Oh, that's good. Well, publicly, they're talking about wet market reform, but that's not what they're telling the cadres to focus on, right?
I don't know. I mean, this is all stuff that's in state-run media. So it's partly, at least, to make it look like they're doing something about it.
Yeah, there are issues like they say the type of bat that carries this strain of coronavirus isn't found within 100 miles of Wuhan. So it would be strange for instance, for this wet market to be selling that kind of bat.
Well, I don't think the wet market was selling any bats, actually.
Yeah, there is no evidence of that to begin with. Meanwhile, nearby, there are two labs researching bat coronaviruses.
I have some thoughts on that, but maybe we should talk about that later.
Okay, we can get back to that
topic.
Shelley?
I'm actually wondering, back to the propaganda narrative issue, when you were describing the similarities between the Soviet and the CCP propaganda about how they must portray themselves as the rising power and the rest of the world as declining power, it seems like we really buy into that here in the US. Like, we really, a lot of people really believe that, like, China is like this technocratic meritocracy of the future. Was it that way with the Soviet propaganda?
In many respects, it was. And it's weird to think about in retrospect. But if you look at it at the time, I was in graduate school then, analyzing Soviet propaganda and focusing on the Soviet security apparatus. That's the KGB. And how this was right during the Glasnost period. And in fact, it coincides with China today because it was right during and after the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in Soviet-occupied Ukraine, where the party line, even under Gorbachev, there was still a strong party line. All of a sudden, the party couldn't deal with the fact that there was an international crisis that they couldn't control coming from a facility that they ran. And they tried to cover it up. And it was that Chernobyl nuclear accident that was a trigger for the collapse of the Soviet Communist Party. So there are a lot of parallels there. In the Soviet period, where you had big companies like Pepsi and different energy companies and General Electric and others, they were being used as indirect Soviet propaganda outlets in the United States and elsewhere to say, hey, the Soviet Union isn't that bad. We can't do anything to promote them. They're a permanent part of the international scene. We can't do anything provocative that would upset them, and so forth. And you had a lot of people in the American and international political and diplomatic establishments that took the same view. They were accustomed to the Soviet Union. Some of them even liked the Soviet Union, not as sympathizers, but it was a comforting, stable force in the world, and they couldn't imagine a world without the Soviet Union. In fact, when I was working in my graduate work, I was also helping anti-communist movements inside the Soviet bloc, and I was in Moscow at the time the Soviet Union was collapsing in 1991. And happened to be in the Kremlin the very day that Boris Yeltsin had Russia secede from the USSR. So it was right in the middle of this whole collapse. And I got to see this as an insider and as a participant. At the same time, Yeltsin's people were alarmed that the Bush 41 administration was not supporting their cause. In fact, Yeltsin's foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrev, told me that the Bush administration could not bear the idea, couldn't fathom the idea, of thinking of a world without a USSR or a USSR without a Communist Party. It was beyond their imagination to grasp because they didn't know. It had been that way all their lives, and they didn't know what to do with it if there was to be some change. The exact same thing's happening today, where people in the State Department, in the many various think tanks, in the intelligence community and elsewhere, cannot believe that there could ever be something beyond the People's Republic of China, or that the Chinese people could ever be ruled by anything but the Chinese Communist Party. It's sort of accepted this. It's not so much resignation to it as it is, yeah, this is a fact, and let's just deal with it and make the most of it.
That's funny, because there's definitely no country that's run by ethnically Chinese people that has a system different from the Communist Party.
Well, but can you imagine, though, the thinking that our foreign policy establishment cannot think beyond the CCP, like as if the CCP is the be-all and end-all of everything? It doesn't mean that they're, you know, followers of Marx and Engels and Mao. It just means the CCP is part of their, you know, comfort level and they can't see anything beyond it. So it's dangerous to blame.
They can't imagine that it could be like Taiwan because Taiwan doesn't exist.
There we go.
It doesn't exist. And it should be right. It's and that's really the official line. We have the one country, two systems model that everyone knew was a fake model anyway. But when the Republic of China government that founded the United Nations and it was a United States ally against the Japanese imperial regime in World War II. Remember, Mao was hiding in the mountains at the time. They're liking to claim credit for their victory in World War II, but they were fighting the nationalists, not the imperial Japanese. But the world is such where really who has the golden rule? He who has the gold rules. And by the 1970s, it was clear that the mainland China was ascendant. Therefore, the China Republic in Taiwan was an annoyance and it had to go.
I mean, I don't know if hearing you describe how the U.S. political establishment looked at the Soviet Union versus how they're looking at the CCP now, I'm not sure whether to be encouraged or depressed.
Oh, be encouraged, because things changed in the Soviet Union, and it was really because we were not on our guard there that somebody like Putin rose. If you look at it, you know, there were warnings at the time that the KGB was on the ascendancy. It was taking advantage of the collapse of the Communist Party. It was maintaining its system as the core of the control structure. All foreign joint ventures had to have a KGB officer as a vice president. And this was giving rise to a gangster state that was controlled by the KGB, just like a gangster state that rose up within the Communist Party in China and the Ministry of State Security Service and the fundamental role that that has played in building all these CCP tycoons around the world.
It's interesting, you know, that foreign companies in Russia need to have a KGB person, because to Americans, like, that obviously sounds really bad, right? But in China, like, whether it's IKEA or McDonald's or whatever, they still have to have a Chinese Communist Party secretary or many Communist Party members forming a party committee within that American company.
Well, and I'm sure it's all honest and above board, and none of these Communist Party officials are on the take. And can you imagine an American company engaging in such grotesquely corrupt relations with ruling officials in any other country in the world?
Well, they're not as rich.
These companies would be put on trial. But the sheer corruption of these big Western companies in China is staggering. And the regime couldn't survive without that corruption.
Do you think the coronavirus is going to change any of that?
I think so, especially if we keep pushing. If we back off, we meaning free people in the outside the mainland, if we back off and do not hold the Chinese Communist Party responsible for the virus, morally responsible, legally responsible, financially responsible, then the CCP will win. That's why the party is so desperate to deflect blame to anyone else and to manipulate our own internal political system to say, hey, this is a really good campaign issue. Let's look at Trump's opponents. They're also blaming him. So let's exploit this. And that's precisely what you see happening.
Now, Chernobyl was 1986, and the Soviet Union didn't collapse until 5 years later, 1991.
Right.
So, you know, even if this is the CCP virus is a kind of trigger, there's still going to have to be a lot more straws before the camel's back breaks.
Right. And this is why we have to move quickly to demand accountability. The more time it takes, the more foot dragging or caution there is, the more the CCP and its Western allies will be able to regroup and to not only reclaim the narrative, but to dominate the policy.
So basically, we need the China equivalent of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Exactly. This is where Hong Kong comes into play. Think of the way East Berlin and West Berlin, the divided city. So you had a free section of Berlin, which was the capital of Soviet-occupied East Germany. But it was this little pocket of freedom. It was part of the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, and it was occupied by the democratic allies, US and Britain and France. And that was such a danger to the Soviet system that the Soviets had to build a wall around that part of the city. Similar analogy can be made with Hong Kong. You can see the wall being erected very rapidly in a very different way in Hong Kong through the co-optation of Hong Kong politicians, co-optation of Hong Kong businesses, and now the recent roundup of Hong Kong opposition leaders.
Yeah, I mean, we spent about a month last year in Hong Kong covering the protests. And one thing I realized is that what's really behind it is hostile foreign forces like us.
Yeah, you're very dangerous. Well, this is the thing. People like you are the most subversive of all forces because you're actually on there on the ground working with the local people who have a stake in all of this. And you're giving them a voice to the rest of the world, and as well as, I imagine, within their own area. So you're among the most subversive forces in existence, especially because we know the Western intelligence services aren't active in these kinds of things. They're not particularly good at it. The Chinese regime has been great at exerting diplomatic pressure to make sure that there's no such interference at any significant level. So it's really private initiatives like yours, like human rights and pro-democracy movements and others, private initiatives to get companies to divest from CCP businesses and so forth. Those are the most dangerous subversive forces there. And that's why you have to be branded as a foreign spy and as a public enemy.
But so this means we're not likely to get any CIA funding?
It's just as well. It's so bureaucratic, you wouldn't want it. You're better off on your own.
Well, I was hoping to get CCP funding because, like, we could be like Nathan's hot dogs, right? And we could get that.
Nathan Rich's hot dogs.
How much money do you think the CCP would give us if we were to, you know, offer up our podcast to them?
Just hypothetically. You know, it's not a joke. They would pay you to go out of business.
If we were to pursue this business venture, who do we talk to?
I would talk to the consul in New York, I suppose. He's involved in a lot of these types of subversive activities. But seriously, if you want to really excel professionally, if you want to make a name for yourselves, if you want to be accepted at all the right parties, if you'd like a slice of a venture someplace, and if you'd like maybe an academic or a journalistic chair at a university or at a news organization, the CCP can organize it for you if you change your tone. So you don't even have to go out of business. All you have to do with this podcast is just change your tone. Stop having so many critics on. Have more moderate sounding, reasonable voices that say, we're all in this together. This is all for humanity. Let's all work with the Chinese people, AKA CCP in their terms. And let's fight against this common virus as one. You know, then you'd really take off. You'd probably get your own channel.
This sounds pretty easy. I mean, I've always dreamed of rolling around in a bed of dirty money.
Well, when you say it like that, it sounds so reasonable that we're all in it together. And, you know,
we should definitely cooperate on Beijing's
terms. We are.
Terms.
I mean, these ideological extremists who just want to cause trouble, and they just want to cause more hardship for people by destabilizing things in China when the Chinese people need this kind of communist control because that's the Chinese way. And so you outsiders don't really know what you're talking about. And if you do, you're simply out there to cause trouble. Why don't you just join the future of humanity and all work together with Dr. Tedros at the WHO and the good folks at the UN and Henry Kissinger a few blocks from your studio?
God, what can money buy that would be worth that?
I'll tell you a story about Kissinger. I went to interview him when I was working at the Washington Times 20 years ago this year, actually 20 years ago last month. And it was looking at foreign policy pundits and politicians and figures and where their loyalties really lay. And so I called up Henry Kissinger and I had a question for him, and he was out of the country. He was in, quote, Asia. We know where he really was. So I thought I wouldn't get a response from him, but I waited. And sure enough, he called back. Now, I had a big family and it was dinner time, and I got this call, and sure enough, Dr. Varla, yes, this is Henry Kissinger. You had to call for me. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a prank call, and it was really him. And he knew what the question was because I left it with his receptionist. And the question was, how do you, Dr. Kissinger, as a businessman working with China and as a statesman who gives national security advice for the benefit of the country. How do you separate Henry Kissinger, the businessman, from Henry Kissinger, the statesman? That was the question. It wasn't accusatory at all. Well, he knew the question. He wouldn't let me ask him the question. He kept cutting me off, saying, "Don't you know who I am? I used to be this and that and this. I've written all these books." I said, "Yes, sir, I've read your books. I've read Diplomacy. I've read this. I know." And he was very surprised to know that I'd actually read his books. And he kept cutting me off. And I said, "Sir, will you please let me ask you the question?" And so finally he relented. I asked him the question, "Dr. Kissinger, how do you, as a businessman working with China?" "I don't work with China. I work with American companies working with China." He interrupted. He had to. I said, "Please let me ask the question. How do you, as an American businessman with Chinese business interests, separate your foreign policy advice from Henry Kissinger, the statesman?" And then he said, "What in the world do you think entitles you to ask me such an insulting question?" So from that point, I was blacklisted. And I talked to John Fialka later on, who was then a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He said he had been the last journalist he knew of ever to ask Henry Kissinger that question, and he was blacklisted. And as John Fialka told me, the blacklist lasts at least 5 years, as did happen with me. That's why people don't ask Henry Kissinger those questions.
So what do you mean when you say you were blacklisted for 5 years? What did that mean?
Meaning my name was... I was considered a troublemaker, as a not serious person, as someone who's trying to be disruptive of U.S.-Chinese relations. Maybe I was some sort of provocateur or agent of the John Birch Society or whatever it was, some very negative thing that made it so that I would not be invited to participate in events, foreign policy events. I wouldn't be given access to certain people to interview. I wouldn't be allowed in certain social circles, which really wasn't a big deal for me because I'm not interested in being around those kinds of people. But it's that type of thing that kept me away from any opportunities to get inside information from inside sources on a whole lot of other things pertaining to China or anything else in the world. So I was never part of that sort of Brookings institution, the Henry Kissinger type political and diplomatic establishment.
I mean, that could be a career killer.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So that's why there are so many kiss-ups in academia and in journalism, because they don't want to get blacklisted like that. To me, it was a badge of honor.
You know, hearing this kind of makes the situation we're in make a lot more sense.
Yeah, well, you think you have a PhD from a good university, research university. You graduated first in my class. My dissertation was on the Soviet KGB and under Gorbachev and its reincarnation under Boris Yeltsin. It was the only academic work of its kind at the time. It came out right after, predicted the rise of Vladimir Putin. And I can't get a job at any research university in the United States as a full professor. And I'm not the only one. There are a lot of people like me.
Yeah, we've definitely spoken to, like, for instance, some people in the U.S. military who did not have much of a career after criticizing China, let's just say.
Yeah. And in the intelligence community, you think of intelligence officers, they're not ideological. They're just good intelligence officers, or they might be of any political persuasion. But their analysis is good and it's solid. And where they have a different point of view, they all work together to kind of find a common consensus about the intelligence product that they're creating. Those guys don't get promoted through the system. Look at General Spalding, who was on the National Security Council staff. He was a B-2 pilot, Air Force Brigadier General, linguist in Mandarin, lived in China, and he was booted off the NSC staff.
Yeah, no. We've had him on the show. We've talked to him a couple of times. It's one of the examples, definitely. Well, so do you think this is changing, especially with the coronavirus, the CCP virus?
It is. It's changing, and it's in a not to depress, Shelley said something, she was feeling kind of depressed. Be happy, because it's changing in a good way. All we have to do is just be persistent. When you have everyone from supporters of President Trump to the Washington Post to the New York Times, all saying pretty much, all in agreement, hey, the CCP is responsible for this virus. Somehow, it probably didn't come from a wet lab. There's a lie. There's an official lie that's being perpetrated. People have wised up to that now. You can talk about CCP disinformation and propaganda in polite company now. maybe not at Kissinger's parties because I don't go to them, it's no longer considered fringe or extreme or out of the ordinary to talk about this because it's striking everybody and around the world. So it's not just the United States, but there's something really sick with this Chinese regime. It's wrong. We can all turn our eyes away because we want cheap iPhones or computers or whatever crap we might buy on, you know, Amazon or whatever else. We're starting to recognize, well, wait a minute, if we can pay extra for quality grown, say, food or for things that were manufactured ethically, why can't we pay a little more for products that are not made in communist China? And so the public is starting to realize there's a price we have to pay, whether it's for the reliability of the supply chain or slave labor or whatever other things that people are recently waking up to, that the game will be over for the CCP if the rest of us keep pushing and hold decision makers accountable.
So it really seems like history is repeating itself with the fall of the Soviet Union and what's happening with China right now.
Yeah. And you had the same political fighting. When Reagan was elected president, and even in his re-election in 1984, a lot of his opponents were saying he wants to start a nuclear war. He's a real danger. We have to get rid of him. And this was also echoing Soviet propaganda. Some Americans were consciously doing it, and some were just doing it because it was a handy political theme. What I'd like to see here in the 2000 election, because it's such a widespread issue, is if the political leaders in both parties could simply say, the Chinese Communist Party is to blame for this. Let's hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable. And then we can fight about how to do it among ourselves as an election issue.
I mean, I've always wanted to see Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi hold hands and, you know, talk about their feelings towards China.
And actually, you know, she's been pretty good on certain China issues because San Francisco Chinatown is in her district and it's not all taken over by the CCP yet. So she's been a great supporter of Taiwan in many ways. The House in the past few months passed a unanimous resolution supporting the Taipei Act. So it's not like she doesn't know. And it's not that she's pro CCP, which some of her actions might benefit CCP, but she's really not pro that way. It's just a question of there's so much internal political turmoil here that it's easy to use this stuff as a weapon, which the CCP recognizes. And this gets back to its propaganda themes. If you look at the party propaganda and trace the timeline, you'll see not only how certain CCP propaganda themes have infiltrated into American media discourse and punditry and political discourse, but also the other way around, how the CCP has borrowed catchphrases and trigger words from American politics and thrown that back at us to politicize the issue, to use the coronavirus as a weapon to get us to fight amongst each other instead of fighting the CCP.
Oh, yes, we've definitely seen that.
The racism thing, especially.
That's the best effective trigger of all. Yeah. Now, if you say Winnie the Pooh with chopsticks is a racist trope, that's what's happening now in Atlanta, where Vice just yesterday had an article about how racist this is. And it's obviously a hate crime against all ethnic Chinese people because they're linking Winnie the Pooh to Wuhan. And now they want to get the Georgia police involved, but Georgia doesn't have a hate crime statute. So there's this agitation to make it a federal hate crime and bring in the FBI to investigate these street art pranks of Winnie the Pooh.
I think it's anti-English because Winnie the Pooh is actually from England, right?
Well, I was gonna say someone should tell the Hong Kong people who kept making, you know, political cartoons and
The Hong Kong people are so racist against Chinese people.
Really? Yeah. I mean, not even Xi Jinping called it racist. He said, this is directed at me personally because I look like Winnie the Pooh. He didn't say it's anything against the Chinese people. But yeah, so you look at this, so you can see how the CCP is egging on a lot of our triggers and our in political correctness here or whatever sensitivities we have to exploit it against us. I mean, imagine this, getting the FBI to investigate Winnie the Pooh memes in Atlanta because it offends Xi Jinping. Think of how that has just weaponized our own institutions against ourselves and ourselves against one another. That's part of the propaganda. So it's not just simply sending out themes and messages as we trace in our timeline. Even this recent one of Trevor Noah on that TikTok, a 30-second video that's being sent out by China Global TV, where he's saying, oh, it's not the Wuhan virus anymore because it's not Wuhan. It's the America virus now because it's in America. And then he gives the smile and the thumbs up, and then you get the CGTV logo over it. I haven't heard Trevor Noah complain that he's being used for Chinese communist propaganda, but that's what's happened.
Jeez.
Well, on the plus side, he'll have more access now.
Well, he'll have more money for more markets. I mean, look at, see, this is another part of propaganda, which is not coronavirus related or CCP virus related. Yeah, see how I've been acclimated. I live on Capitol Hill, okay? So I'm being acclimated to say coronavirus instead of CCP virus. So my apologies. If you look at, we call it Wuhan virus for shorthand, but we'll take CCP. It's fine. You look at how, say, Hollywood has been weaponized against us for two reasons. First, because Hollywood's looking at that world's largest market for its movies, but also you get a lot of cheap labor running the CGI computer graphics to make all the special effects, and that's being done now in mainland post-production studios. So you have those two things that take the actual themes away from movies, whether it's something the re-release of Top Gun.
Right, get rid of that Taiwan flag on his jacket. Right.
Yeah, it was the Republic of China flag, remember? Because it was an old World War II type jacket where the Republic of China was being run out of Peking. It was not yet a Taiwan flag. So the old Republic of China flag had to go. And then in Red Dawn, of course, it was no longer a CCP invasion of the United States, but it was some absurd, you know, North Korean occupation of Idaho that made no sense and looked really foolish. But
they had actually changed Red Dawn in post-production. They'd shot it as the Chinese enemy, and then they spent two more years like redoing it in post.
Hey, Chinese people and North Koreans, they all look alike, right? That's what Hollywood is saying.
Oh, they all look alike. They all talk alike. Wow. They all,
That's true. No one criticized them for that, huh?
No.
Yeah. But this is pressure coming from, whether it's overt pressure to force conformity or it's reverse pressure, meaning you want to do business with us, let's see a better product from you that doesn't offend our party sensitivities. Either way, they've gotten Hollywood to change entire scripts. When have the Chinese communists ever been the bad guys in a movie?
It's been a long time.
When has Mao been a supervillain?
I mean, I have to think back to a Richard Gere movie from the 90s. Yeah. Red Corner is what came to mind.
Yeah, or the 7 years in Tibet, right?
Yeah, the Fallout video game series, fortunately. That's a nuclear war between the U.S. and China.
Yeah. So, but there's very few. That plus, of course, China Unscripted.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I feel like we should have you on again to talk about some more of these like Soviet Chinese Communist Party propaganda techniques.
Oh, and we didn't even get into the timeline. It's if you want to take a shortcut to it, go to communistpropaganda.com.
That's a great URL.
I used to have governmentofchina.com, but then I let it lapse and somebody else got it. But the communistpropaganda.com is the shortcut to the Center for Security Policy website page, where we've got, as of today, it's about a 150-page long day-to-day tracking of CCP propaganda themes, Chinese government actions, and then other actions in response. So that tracks as much of it as we can. It's really cumbersome, but it's really detailed. And you can see, because everything links to the original source, how the line is developed and how it changes, how Western societies respond to it, and then how actors, even in American politics or the media or whatever, end up embracing it or pushing it, or how those actions are thrown back at us. Whether it's sympathetic to Beijing or even hostile to it, the regime has all of us targeted somehow to figure out how to provoke any of us, for better or for worse, into saying or doing something that will benefit the regime.
I mean, it's so important to have documentation like that, because we're definitely seeing a lot of selective memory, even from 2 months ago in the U.S. about like how the virus started, or, you know, why didn't we lock down America in, you know, early February or the end of January, just like forgetting exactly
how WHO told us not to.
Yeah, just forgetting how this whole thing happened. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, and tracking the WHO line is also in the timeline. But if you go back, some of the first to say Chinese coronavirus was the CCP itself, until the CCP said you can't say that, it's racist.
Oh, yeah. They went back and started erasing the replacing their old headlines that said Wuhan virus.
Well, I mean, the Communist Party itself is kind of racist. I mean,
no,
look at how they target people based on ethnicity in Xinjiang.
That's a whole different topic.
That's true.
But yes, we will put a link to communistpropaganda.com.
Communistpropaganda.com is the direct link, and it's at the Center for Security Policy website.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. This was really depressing, but
also
quite informing.
Encouraging.
Oh, it should be uplifting, because there are so many opportunities for us. All we have to do is fight back and not give up. And you guys can't give up unless, if I see you at certain parties or I hear news, I know you've been co-op. Other than that, keep doing what you're doing.
Don't worry, we don't have that kind of party culture. all right. Yeah, thanks. Take care.
Okay. Well, be good. Bye-bye.
Oh, hey, before we wrap up, Shelley, you said you had something you wanted to talk about the labs.
Oh, well, now the labs are a big, controversial talking point again, right? Mm-hmm. Like they kind of, it was something that had been brought up at the beginning of the coronavirus, but then outbreak, but then kind of slowly petered out. And now it's become almost in the U.S. like a partisan political thing, since a lot of the people talking about whether it came from a lab are Republicans.
So, oh, good. Well, except for the U.S. intelligence agency that's
They're looking into it, but like the way it's being reported on is interesting, because like I've seen news organizations or reporters compare it to like the Iraq WMDs
thing. My gosh.
So it's already being kind of like pre-smeared before we have
sort of the idea that like this is Trump trying to distract from his own failure.
Oh yeah, or the Republicans in general trying to distract, because I don't think Trump has come out saying anything about that, really.
Yeah, I saw a press conference where like a reporter asked him that, and he was like, you know what U.S. intelligence agents tell me? They tell me a lot.
Yeah, there's plenty, because we use that clip in the...
They tell me plenty.
Yeah, but so there's no way of knowing. But I think, you know, Senator Tom Cotton was one of the first people kind of publicly talking about this, and then he's been smeared for it, because people kind of were like, he's accusing people of saying it's a conspiracy theory about, you know, bioweapons or whatever. And then he had to keep coming out and saying, I did not say it was bioweapons. I did not say it was bioweapons.
Yeah.
And he had a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal where he kind of laid out his case for the lab leaks. And, you know, that's a lot of the evidence that we talked about in that episode of China Uncensored. I think what's interesting about this is I don't know that it came from a lab. Like J. Michael Waller, he was sure that it came from a lab. But what do you guys think?
I mean, I definitely think it is a very probable explanation. I don't know if we're ever going to have a definitive answer to it. I mean, I don't know. It might be like one of those things where after the Chinese Communist Party falls and... you know, like in East Berlin, like you get access to all the Stasi files and then the old KGB files. And then, you know, like everything that has happened.
Yeah. I mean, I do believe that it's possible to have come from a lab, that just basically there was an accident, a leakage, mainly because I believe very strongly in the power of human incompetence.
That's beautiful. I've always admired that about you.
My incompetence.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I thought it was his belief. Well,
I wasn't going there with it.
Wow, so. Okay. Suddenly it's tense. Well, actually, what I was wondering is, I think an interesting reason that people are believing the lab thing again, which I'm kind of with you guys where I'm like, it's possible, but I'm not ready to say it's definitely the lab. One reason also is because there have been multiple diseases that have come from wet markets, like bird flu. Mm-hmm. Like every bird flu outbreak is related to some kind of like live poultry market where like it jumps from the birds to the people working at the market. SARS, the event came from a wet market where they were selling civet cats that had been infected with bat coronaviruses. So, you know, that's Yeah. It's not impossible for it to be just a natural thing that happened. And I think one reason that the Communist Party is pushing back so hard on the lab leak idea is because they think that if it's a natural, like, zoonotic thing, they can push the blame off more. It's exactly what they did with previous natural disasters, like the, you know, Great Famine, mm-hmm. right, which was caused by the Great Leap Forward. But in China, people were told that this was a natural disaster that happened.
What's the Chinese term? It's like the 3 years of bad weather.
I forget the actual term, but...
Right.
But yeah, the idea that, like, we were not responsible, it was just bad luck. It was like an act of God.
Yeah.
Well, except not God.
It was an act of Mao.
Well, it was an act.
Well, I mean, he told everyone to, like, not work in the fields and instead produce useless steel in their backyards. And so the crops rotted and...
Yeah, I mean, it was a little more complicated than that. But yes, it was basically caused by the Great Leap Forward.
Right.
But the whole idea, I think, is that they want to, like, get the attention off the labs because that makes them more culpable. But I actually don't think it necessarily makes them that much more culpable. I think that the worst thing they did was not accidentally leak a virus from a lab or, you know, let it happen in a wet market or whatever. You know, you could argue that they're also culpable for allowing these wet markets that people have said for decades are going to breed diseases to keep operating the way they are. So it's mostly, I think, that the cover-up that we've talked about so much time, like, that's why they're actually responsible for
this. And that makes everything else they do seem super shady as well. Like, if you are transparent about it, then it's like, oh yeah, I can understand how, like, a mistake can happen.
Right. And I don't
And then they could have just blamed the lab, right? And fired a bunch of people, and then the party would be like, it wasn't our fault.
Right.
But the cover-up is their fault. So really, American intelligence should not be investigating whether or not it was a lab. They should be investigating the cover-up.
Well, I think it's still important to know where super contagious diseases are coming from.
So maybe we should be more careful about how labs handle super contagious diseases that could kill hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah. I mean, I think also the CCP is partly to blame for the virus lab leak story coming back, because they have been pushing so hard the idea that the virus came from somewhere else that was not Wuhan.
Uh-huh.
Like, the latest thing is now that they're claiming that maybe it could have multiple birthplaces around the globe, because that's definitely how viruses work.
Well, why not, Shelley?
Well, like, it could have mysteriously appeared in both the US and Italy and China. Unrelated, but around the same time.
The natural world is just so mysterious and beautiful.
But the fact that they were pushing back so hard at the fact that it started in Wuhan made people go,
wait a minute. Yeah, the cover up and all of that stuff. Hey, it was the US. It was Italy that began. What more are you trying to hide?
Yeah, exactly. It made a lot of people who at first thought that this was a conspiracy theory or unlikely be like, maybe it is more likely. Just because you're looking at the propaganda. So, I mean, I don't think we'll know. But I think the point I wanted to make is that regardless of where it came from, the CCP is responsible because of the cover-up, not because of the
how it got out.
And I think they're pushing back so hard on the lab thing because they want to take blame and put it on, like, a natural disaster, mm-hmm. you know? So then they can do all of their, like, we were the victims here, that kind of narrative, more so than they already are.
Yeah. Well, with any luck, it will not work this time, and people will finally have wised up to the Chinese Communist Party.
I don't know. Did you hear what I said about how it's become a partisan political fight in the U.S. between the Democrats and the Republicans?
No, I tend not to listen to you.
Oh, I've
That's
known
not
that
true.
For
Remember
years.
The jokes on the show where I say, what's that, Shelley? That implies I am listening to you.
That does imply that you aren't listening to me.
All right. Well, I guess we'll probably wrap up on that note. Just one final clarification for the lab thing is that the U.S. is looking into multiple scenarios and how the virus escaped, not just the lab. So... And with that, I think we'll wrap up this episode. Thanks for watching. We're back on filming this. If you're watching on YouTube, you can actually see our faces as we talk.
Let us know if you prefer to see this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let us know in the comments below. You know, be sure if you're watching, yeah, subscribe to China Unscripted on whatever medium you prefer to watch it on. And yeah, stay tuned for more from China Uncensored, China Unscripted, and America Uncovered. We're very busy in 2020.
It's just all coronavirus all the time.
All coronavirus all the time.
Yeah.
Can't stop.
Just wait till we get into more of the, you know, Soviet propaganda, or like, you know, going back for like 50 or 100 years of Soviet propaganda.
Oh, I think that stuff is fascinating.
Oh yeah. No, it's interesting.
Oh yeah. Let us know if you want that podcast.
Yeah, or like what topics you want.
Actually, I don't care. I want that podcast. So it'll
We're going to do it anyway, regardless of what you say.
Try to stop me. All right. Well, yeah. Thank you for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
Talk to you next time.